It's appropriate. I want to thank the Extreme History Project for sponsoring this talk tonight. They put on a lot of great programs, and hopefully this will live up to their standards. It is interesting. This is for the Extreme History Project, because when you look at the life of John Coulter, he was either extremely brave or extremely crazy. Okay, we've been through that part. Here's the West of John Coulter. Actually, it's the West as shown by William Clark, who prepared this map a couple of years after the conclusion of the Lewis and Clark expedition. Now, I have not used one of these before, but we'll try and point out a few things, and then we'll get into better detail of it later on. Missouri River, here's the Yellowstone, Jackson Lake, and then back up here, what was labeled on the map as Eustis Lake is now Yellowstone Lake. The Three Forks, right here. So that's kind of the area. It wasn't a bad map. It was not to perfect scale. William Clark was a pretty good cartographer. And what makes it interesting is John Coulter helped him to put this map together when he finally went back to St. Louis in 1810. This was pretty much the standard map of the American West, at least the territory of John Coulter. It was until John C. Fremont and his explorations a couple of decades later. We're going to be talking about a time period in American history that launched westward expansion, accelerated westward expansion. Now, one could arguably say that all began with Columbus, but keep in mind that most settlements were on the other side of the Appalachian Mountains, and venturing out into this wilderness, a lot of people didn't know what was out there. A lot of people didn't even know how far it extended. Louisiana Purchase, Thomas Jefferson, that kind of changes things. And he decides to send an expedition. And we know all about that, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, to go out and find out, guys, what did I just buy from France? And so one reason for the mission was to kind of establish an American presence in the West. The Louisiana Purchase extended on up to the Rocky Mountains. The West Coast, different story. That wasn't part of it. You had British traders in there, Russian traders, Spanish traders, and Spanish missionaries had already gone as far north as San Francisco, California. Jefferson wanted to make a statement to these other European powers that the United States was here, this is now our territory, and we want to exert influence and control over it. And I think maybe most of the message was sent directly to the British, because the British fur trade system started, first of all, in 1670 with the Hudson Bay Company, and then followed in the next century by the Northwest Company. They had established a wonderful network of fur trading posts into the Canadian wilderness, and were starting to exert some influence onto tribes that were in the Louisiana Purchase, especially the Blackfeet. The Blackfoot got along okay with the British. They got along, as it turned out, they got along with the British better than they did the Americans. There are several reasons. Foremost, and we'll talk more about them as we go on, but one of the systems that the British employed was when they built their fur trading posts, they pretty much stayed on the periphery of Blackfoot country and invited the Blackfeet to come to them with the furs, and they could trade at the forts, and those furs could then go back east to Montreal and make their way to Europe, where they were extremely valuable. It was a very, very valuable industry. The British didn't go in to the territory that much. Here come the American fur traders. John Coulter, first and foremost, a whole different ballgame. Rather than rely on the forts and the Indians to always come to them, the American fur trappers went into Blackfoot country, did the trapping themselves, and that's what really irritated the Blackfeet, big time. But anyway, Lewis and Clark assembling the expedition, they needed to find a certain group of guys, so to speak. Lewis told Clark, while Lewis was off gathering supplies and other materials for the expedition, told Clark, "We need good hunters, stout, healthy, unmarried men, accustomed to the woods and capable of bearing bodily fatigue in pretty considerable degree." I think after a couple of months on the expedition, they probably, those guys, wanted him to amend to a considerable degree. It was one hell of a degree. It was a lot of work. As it turned out, members of the expedition, these men, would consume up to or exceed 9 pounds of meat a day just to keep their energy. Therefore, you needed some good hunters along with these stout, healthy, unmarried men. And John Coulter, although he had a son at this time, we don't know if he was married or not. We don't know anything about the mother of his son. John Coulter certainly foot the bill as a hunter. He was one of 9 recruits for the expedition who came from Kentucky. Now, in Kentucky, a lot of very well-known frontiersmen made their mark. That includes Daniel Boone and a lot of those who are unnamed. John Coulter is one of them because as white expansion accelerated west of the Appalachians after the French and Indian War, it was resisted by the Wyandot, the Chickasaw, Cherokee, Shawnee, and other tribes. A lot of fighting in the Kentucky frontier. The reliance also upon game for food made one have to become a good hunter. With a flintlock rifle, you wanted to make the first shot count. You really had to, because after that first shot, you'd have to roll another ball in, you'd have to pack in the powder, get out the ramrod, put it in. If you missed that first shot, that deer was long gone, or what you were aiming at. If you were in a close conflict, say with an American Indian tribe, you wanted that first shot to count, because while you're reloading your flintlock, the Native American could get off 3, 4, maybe more arrows. And as we'll see, it was John Coulter who gained the reputation of being a pretty good shot. The flintlock rifles, very, very important at this time in American history, but kind of cumbersome, heavy. The other thing, too, is in these early days of gunpowder, just kind of an aside here, early days of gunpowder, when you shot flintlocks, if you had a lot of soldiers at close range, it sent up tremendous clouds of gunpowder smoke. That's why England had their soldiers in red, the redcoats. So if they were in close combat, they didn't end up accidentally shooting each other. You know? Now, the Americans wore, in the Revolution, the Americans wore blue, light blue. But then again, maybe they weren't worried about it, because just shoot the guys that got the red on, okay? So, we first hear about John Coulter after he was hired in Kentucky by William Clark. We first hear about him in the journals when William Clark wrote, "I moved into my hut. Cloudy morning, Coulter killed a deer and a turkey." A couple of months later, this would have been early 1804, Coulter showed his rabble-rousing side He got drunk, got in a fight with a couple of the other members of the expedition. They were all threatened with court-martial, but they all apologized and kind of threw themselves on the mercy of Lewis and Clark, who said, well, oh, all right, if you guys behave yourself from here on out. And that Coulter did. And one reason probably they let Coulter off the hook is because he was such a great shot. Well, the 49 members of the expedition, the Corps of Discovery, finally head up the Missouri River. Coulter, and he was one of those sent out almost daily on scouts to hunt. And evidently, he and the other hunters fulfilled their responsibility by getting enough game. 49 people. Now, some of those didn't need 9 pounds of meat a day. But you do the math there. That's 450 pounds a day. Jeez, and they didn't, you know, there weren't any side dishes to speak of, I don't think, on the expedition. As the expedition progressed, it was Coulter and 10 others who rode with Clark in August of 1805 to scout the Salmon River. After they concluded that route to the Columbia was not feasible, it would not work, Clark selected Private Coulter, as opposed to one of the sergeants present, to get that message back to Meriwether Lewis. While hunting near Traveler's Rest in September of 1805, this, of course, after they had wintered at the Mandan villages, Coulter was the one who made initial contact with the Salish. And when they saw him, probably the first white person they ever saw, Coulter, his smarts from his time in Kentucky, his common sense, took his rifle, laid it down on the ground. That pretty much alleviated all the fear in the Salish. Oh, maybe we can trust this guy. And then through sign language, Coulter talked them into coming to the main camp. And from the Salish, they learned about the Nez Perce on the other side of the mountains. Once they got to the west coast, upon reaching Point Ellis, the Corps, they were bogged down by miserable weather, rain, wind. Coulter and two privates were sent out in a Clatsop canoe in November to explore the coastline for a better campsite. They returned the next day with word of a sandy beach in a nearby bay. That's just what Lewis and Clark were looking for. They relocated to said bay, and then later on moved into the interior where they were closer to game to feed them during the winter. And in doing that, of course, they established Fort Clatsop. Well, following the winter encampment at Fort Clatsop, from what I understand, it was elk for breakfast, elk for lunch, elk for dinner, and nothing to drink but pure water. They'd had their last party at the Great Falls. That's when they ran out of the whiskey they had. So anyway, they were literally on the wagon. So they started to make their way back. And at Traveler's Rest in 1806, they split up into two groups. Clark led a portion to the headwaters of the Missouri, then by land to the Yellowstone River. Meriwether Lewis led a balance up the Missouri, and then when Clark got to the Three Forks, he dispatched Coulter and 10 others in canoes to meet with Lewis. Now, we'll find out in a little bit, there's a lot of aspects to John Coulter that historians debate. No two mountain men buffs can agree on some aspects of his life. But that's kind of typical, because to give you an example, the late Don Nell, for years a Bozeman resident, described himself as a Lewis and Clark nut. It was really his hobby, his passion, and you have a lot of others in this area all over the world. And the group here in Bozeman, one group said, yes, Clark, led by Sacagawea, came across the valley, and he turned left at Lindley Park. And the other group said, no. He turned left at Bozeman Deaconess Hospital. Now, this is why Donnell was so willing to call himself and the others Lewis and Clark nuts. They debated and debated, and finally the consensus is Clark, led by Sacagawea and that portion of the expedition, they turned left at Bozeman Deaconess Hospital, headed for Kelly Creek, Kelly Canyon, over that way and on over the Bozeman Pass. But anyway, it was Coulter who went up the Missouri with others. Lewis, as it turned out, and his men had a scrape with the Blackfeet. At least one warrior was killed, probably two. And fortuitously, they met at the junction of the Marias and the Missouri, just as Lewis and his group were getting the heck out of there back to the Missouri. Coulter then was one of those who accompanied them for the balance of the way, often sent out in a canoe on his own, sometimes separated for days, so he could go hunting. And as they approached the present-day border of Montana and North Dakota, the Lewis group met, the Lewis group met a couple of westbound trappers, Joseph Dixon and Forrest Hancock. I've got this darn head cold that won't go away. But anyway, they met these two trappers. Coulter got to know them. They proceeded on towards the Mandan villages, linked up with Clark. And Coulter, in meeting with these guys, found out that one beaver pelt, could bring $4 to $5 in St. Louis. Now, in 1806, that's pretty serious money, okay? Each beaver pelt weighed about a pound. So trappers had a habit of caching in the ground and in other areas their pelts as they moved west. And then as they headed back, they would unearth those, load them up in a canoe on the river, and take them back to St. Louis. It was really tempting, too tempting for Coulter. Most of the guys on the expedition were thankful to have completed this expedition and to have gotten out of it in one piece. They were anxious to get back home. Coulter asked for permission to join these two guys, go up the Yellowstone, and trap. And he was given permission. He was given permission because of his excellent duty, his excellent service on the expedition. We don't know if anybody else asked to get off the expedition early, but Coulter is the only one who was given that permission. So, a couple of years away from quote-unquote civilization, Coulter turns around and they head back up the Missouri, and they start to make their way up the Yellowstone. But for some reason, this partnership didn't last. They just didn't get along. Technically, also, something to note, they were, at that point, breaking the law because government trading licenses only permitted bartering. Go back to what we talked about earlier about the British. That's all you could do. You didn't have the right to hunt and trap in Blackfoot territory. They were breaking that law. The Blackfoot, another thing that they would eventually come to resent from the traders, especially the American traders, is the fact that they traded guns and ammunition to their traditional enemies, the Crow and the Flathead. So an incursion into Blackfoot country, and Coulter, of course, knew what Lewis had run into on the return trip. An incursion into Blackfoot country was really kind of rolling the dice. And he did know, even though he had not been in the Yellowstone River country himself, he did know that the Crow were friendly to the whites. He knew the Blackfoot were not so friendly. He thought it was because of what had happened with Meriwether Lewis. Now, in some Blackfeet traditions, that is mentioned. If you go back to that incident, one of them had a peace medal that Lewis had given him, and he was the one killed. And the men said to Lewis, "What do we do with the medal?" Lewis said, "Leave it on him so they'll know who we are. Now get on your horses and let's get the hell out of here." You know. That comes down in Blackfoot tradition as not a nice way to treat your hosts. And so there might be some veracity to that argument. So anyway, the partnership breaks up. Coulter decides, well, after a winter of trapping, decides, okay, time to go back to St. Louis. Here's his second chance to get out of there. On his way down, he reaches the Platte River, and he meets a fur trapping group coming up the river that was led by Manuel Lisa. There were also some veterans on that in that group of the Lewis and Clark expedition, George Drouillet, John Potts, Peter Weiser. So it was kind of a reunion. Lisa talked Coulter into turning around and coming back with him to help him establish fur trading posts and to trap in Blackfoot country. Now, this gets back to the original premise when we started out. Was he crazy or brave? Anyway, okay, so he goes back up the river. He's with this new fur trading expedition. Manuel Lisa had very ambitious plans. He wanted to build a fort out at the Three Forks. And Coulter and other members of the expedition said, "Forget it. No way. Have you heard of the Blackfoot?" So they talked him out of it. They established Manuel's Fort, Fort Raymond, named for Manuel's son. The French is R-E-Y-M-O-N, and down on maps it came down as the English Raymond. But nonetheless, they established a fort at the junction of the Bighorn River and the Yellowstone. In October 1807, that's where we are now, 1807, now that the man had been hunting, had killed enough game to dry the meat to last it through the winter, Lisa sent some of them out to find the Crow and other tribes, even Blackfeet if they could, to establish relations and so they could trade furs with them. He wanted his own men in Indian territory trapping furs themselves. But he also wanted the Indians to be able to come to the fort. So Coulter leaves in October. Keep that in mind. He's heading into the Absarokas and what is Yellowstone Park in October. He and a couple of others, although they went their separate ways. Now that is what is depicted on this map. Clark included Coulter's route through Yellowstone. Here's a part of it right here. You really can't, on this big screen, you really can't make it out. But if you Google it, you can see the dotted lines. Maybe Coulter wished he could have Googled and reached them. But here's a close-up of the area that we're talking about. The white line here, all right, you can see it kind of a zigzag all over the place, kind of a trip. That's the route that John Coulter took. But historians have modified his route through the years. They've not been able to exactly agree just where he went. Some historians also think immediately after his falling out with Hancock and Dixon, he made his first trip through the park and had already established relations with the Crows and other tribes. We don't know. We do know this was the second one, or this one for sure, I should say, was done 1807, 1808. Now, the argument for the theory that Coulter had made a previous trip was because he really did know his way around, something he may very well have learned from the crows. The unfortunate thing with John Coulter, he was literate, but he didn't leave a journal. So it's one of those mysteries. But anyhow, the latest theory as to exactly where he went, and as I mentioned, there have been Mountain Men buffs, Lewis and Clark buffs, John Coulter buffs, who have spent summers in Yellowstone Park walking these routes to try and figure out, now, what drainage would he have gone down? Where would he have gone? It was middle of winter. Did he have snowshoes? Probably. A lot of furs to keep warm. He knew how to build a fire. He knew how to hunt. So he could pretty much take care of himself. But where did he go? The route, as shown on Clark's map, is extremely confusing. Once, down here in the lower corner, lower left corner, by where it says Wind River, that suggests he went into Idaho, modern-day Idaho. Some historians don't think he did. This is the latest theory that has been put forward by two authors, Ron Anglin, Larry Morse. They are the authors of The Mystery of John Coulter, the Man Who Discovered Yellowstone. That Coulter left his camp near present-day Pryor, Montana. Oops. Yeah, present-day Pryor, made his way down Pryor Creek to present-day Warren, and then bobbed and weaved his way to the west to the Clark's Fork of the Yellowstone. Okay? And from there, on over Coulter Pass, thence to the headwaters of Soda Butte Creek, south to the Lamar River, following it to present-day Tower Fall, then went over Dunraven Pass. You can see it up there, this handy visual aid that I prepared. Well, I'm not a cartographer, I just proved it. But you get the general idea. After he passed through the Hayden Valley, thence to the west thumb of the Yellowstone Lake, onto Two Ocean Plateau, which is to the immediate south of said Yellowstone Lake. From there, down to Brooks Lake. I should say Jackson Lake here, Jackson Lake here. Then he made his way down to Brooks Lake right here. He may have wintered with the crow near present-day Dubois. I guess the American pronunciation is Du Bois, right? As opposed to the girls. Ah, oh, forget it. I'm sorry. All right. That was bad. I'm sorry. And then from there, he went on down to Bull Lake, then made his way back. Made his way back through the Owl Creek Mountains to the South Fork of the Shoshone. And as he approached modern-day Cody, this is where the legend of Coulter's Hell comes from. You may have heard that with all the mud pots and geysers and so forth in Yellowstone Park, that present-day Yellowstone Park was John Coulter's hell. Coulter's Hell. It wasn't. Coulter's Hell refers to a series of sulfur rocks, sulfur embedded along the South Fork of the Shoshone that let off a terrible smell and gases. So it doesn't really talk about Yellowstone Park. Coulter did go into modern-day Yellowstone Park. He was the first white guy to see it. But Coulter's Hell centers, and the river, after he first found it, was given the very appropriate name of the Stinking Water River. You know? Those guys didn't waste time trying to come up with a name for something. You know, just cut right to the quick. Eventually, it was changed to the Shoshone River. So anyway, that is Coulter's Hell. Another legend about Coulter's Hell is that when he got back to the fort and he made his way pretty much the way he came down, heading way up there in the top to Fort Raymond, made his way pretty much as he came, past Pompey's Pillar and so forth. One of the legends is that the other trappers at the fort, when Coulter gave them a description of the smelly water and the gases emanating from it, that they dubbed it Coulter's Hell. They thought he was crazy. But actually, the phrase Coulter's Hell did not appear until a couple of decades later in a book by Washington Irving, who wrote extensively of the Western fur trade, Western exploration. So there's another mystery about John Coulter. You know, did his buddies give him a bad time over this, or was that something that and Irving met Coulter, or was that something that came later? It may very well have been from the imagination of Washington Irving. Well, didn't take long before Lisa, still obsessed, still determined to have a presence near the Three Forks, he sent Coulter to go make contact with the Blackfeet and try to convince the tribe of the trapper's peaceful intention. So Coulter said, well, okay. He journeyed to the Three Forks, didn't run into any Blackfoot, but he did run into some Crow and Salish, or Flathead Indians, and was leading them back to Fort Raymond, and all about 800 warriors and John Coulter, the lone white guy, heading back towards Fort Raymond. They were attacked somewhere on the Gallatin River, somewhere in this valley, by about 1,500 Blackfeet. And they had quite the battle. And the Blackfeet, Coulter, because of the way he was dressed, the beard, yada, yada, it was pretty easy for them to determine, oh, they've got a white guy with him. Who is that guy? You know, kind of like what Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Who are those guys? Same kind of thing. But they memorized his appearance. Coulter was wounded in the leg. He fought very bravely. And the Flatheads and the Crows were able to repel the Blackfeet and continue on, and they made it on back to Fort Raymond. A few months later, Coulter again comes back to Blackfeet country, this time with John Potts, who was also an alum, if you will, of the Lewis and Clark expedition. And sometime in early July of 1808, Coulter and Potts, they were in two separate dugout canoes up on the Jefferson River. Coulter said to Potts, I think I hear Indians coming. And Potts' initial reaction was, oh, you're just kind of edgy. It's buffalo. Don't worry about it. Suddenly, there's about 500 Blackfeet on each side of the river telling them, come on over here. We want to see you. They dropped their traps into the river. Coulter obeyed the Blackfoot orders to come to shore. They stripped him naked, disarmed him. He called out to Potts, but Potts says, no, I am not going to shore. So an Indian, we don't know with a flintlock or probably an arrow, shot Potts in the hip. Potts, in return, shot his rifle and shot and killed an Indian. And then a group of Blackfeet hit him with a barrage of arrows, killed him. The Indians pulled the canoe with his body in it to shore and proceeded to hack it to pieces. All this in front of Coulter, and Coulter therefore thought his days were numbered. The chiefs, Blackfoot chiefs, assembled with a few of the warriors, and after talking for a little while, one of them came up to Coulter, standing there in his birthday suit, and said, go. Said this in Crow. Go. Go away. So Coulter started to walk, kind of looked around, turned around every now and then. The chief motioned for him, faster, go faster. And so when he was about 100 yards away at a slow trot, he turned around and noticed that the Braves were taking off their leggings and blankets, and now he figured it out. He was the naked prey. He was literally running for his life. The Madison River, about 5 miles away. So they had been quite a ways up on the Jefferson River. The Madison River, 5 miles away, that's what Coulter headed to. Coulter was in good shape. He was a fast runner. Actually, some believe that the Blackfoot had asked him ahead of time, "How fast? Are you very fast?" And he said, "No." Not true. He was fast. But a 5 mile run, heading for the Madison River, started to heave heavily. Blood started to run out of his nose, run out of his mouth. And he was just running out of gas and turned around and faced the Indian with his hands up, asking in Crow for mercy. But the Brave was not going to show any. The Brave was stunned at what Coulter had done. So surprising. The Brave had his spear. He's going to nail this guy. Then he trips, breaks the spear. Coulter grabs the sharp end of the spear. The Brave asks for mercy in Crow. Coulter kills it, continues his run. The rest of the Indians that have been chasing him are quite a ways behind, but they are still in pursuit. Coulter continues his run, gets to the Madison, dives in the Madison. Now, debate is, okay, what did Coulter hide under? Was it just a log jam, or was it a beaver hut, a beaver house? We think it was a beaver house because beavers, when they build their huts, their homes, they're really quite intricate. They actually have separate floors on them, okay? They were the first high-rise condos in the Gallatin Valley. By going in and under and into the beaver home, Coulter could get out of the water and lay on a portion of it that was dry. If he had gone into just a log jam while the Indians were on top of him, literally trying to find him, hypothermia could very well have set in. I mean, everybody knows how cold Montana rivers are, even in July. So that's why we think it really was a beaver hut. The Indians looked and looked and looked. They couldn't find him. He thought at any minute they were going to set it on fire, the beaver hut, but they didn't. They left. Coulter waited. Darkness fell. Coulter swims out from the beaver home. He's got to get the heck out of there, out of the territory. Now, if he's going to head back to Fort Raymond, which was indeed his intention, if he's going to head back to Fort Raymond, you would think, logic would tell you, from the Three Forks up here, he might just go over the Bozeman Pass, follow the Yellowstone on back. But that, too, was considered part of Blackfoot country. Blackfoot war parties roamed the Yellowstone. His first priority was to get out of Blackfoot country and take his chances with the Crows. So, he didn't go that way. He followed the Gallatin for a distance and then cut over the Gallatin Range. Exactly where, we don't know. I'd like to think, you know, that cutoff road that you can take and you go by those old ruins west of town here and then drop down to the Yellowstone. He might have gone that way. But he made his way over to the Yellowstone River, okay, followed the Yellowstone, right past present-day Minor, Montana, in Park County. Made his way past Dome Mountain, over Coulter Pass, dropped down a little bit. He was worried about Blackfeet. He didn't want to be anywhere near him, to Dead Indian Pass, followed that then to the north with pretty much the usual route, and he gets back to Fort Raymond. Took him 11 days, and it was well over 300 miles. The only thing he had with him, he again was for the most part naked, and he had half a spear. And that was it. He had learned a lot of things from Sacagawea and others during the Lewis and Clark exploration. Specifically, stripped bark could be a good soother. So he would strip bark from saplings, and this would soothe his blistered feet. He had a lot of cactus stuck in his feet from his run up by the Madison River. He could live on currants, breadfruit, choke cherries, gooseberries, buffalo berries, and service berries. He was still plagued by cramps, aches, diarrhea, but he made it. His buddies at the fort hardly recognized him. I mean, you know, this guy walking up and somewhat emaciated, and the beard now is really, really long. So it took him quite a while to recuperate. But he did. And oddly enough, once he got well, the first thing he did, this takes us back, was he brave or was he crazy? The first thing he did, by God, I'm going back to the Three Forks because I want my traps back. Those things are expensive, and they were expensive. They were very important to the fur trader, obviously. I want my traps back. So he makes his way back towards the Three Forks. In the wintertime, he's camped, we think, somewhere in the Gallatin Range here while he's on his way back, and was spotted by Blackfeet, who took a couple of pot shots at him. So once again, he has to skedaddle the valley, this valley, and he takes the same route back over the range down to the Yellowstone. Okay, on his way, he promises God, he prays, he says, that's it, get me out of this, I'll go home, enough. Not quite. Because in the spring of 1810, Coulter was recruited by some representatives of the Missouri Fur Company who had just come up the river. Members of this group included Pierre Menard, Andrew Henry, as in Henry's Fork, and so forth in Idaho, but that's another story. And John Holback, Archibald Pelton, Edward Robinson, just to name a few. So he brings them, okay, all right, you want to go see the Three Forks. So he brings them on back, same route, Coulter Pass. He didn't mess much with the Yellowstone, Coulter Pass, past Dome Mountain. And while they're in Dome Mountain, a huge snowstorm pins them, and pins them for a couple of days. And after the snow had stopped, the sun came out, shining very, very brightly. They got snow blindness. They couldn't move for 2 days. One man begged his friends to kill him because he couldn't stand the pain of his swollen eyeballs and the hot tears that were running out. They did proceed on into the Gallatin, had another brief in the Gallatin Valley, another brief situation with snow blindness, and were told, though it's not verified, that a group of Shoshone rode by, and the men noticed that the Shoshone had put ash from their fires, the dark dust, the ash, the residue of the fire, on their faces to deflect the sunlight so it wouldn't hit their eyes. That's what athletes do today when they're playing out in the sun. Kind of an interesting tidbit there. But anyway, Coulter leads them across the valley. They survive their snowblind incident, heads towards the Three Forks, shows them the site where he had that big fight with the Flathead and Salish a couple of years earlier. There's still bones on the ground of animals and human beings. Some of these guys suddenly got nervous when they saw that, and for very good reason. Anyhow, they do get to the Three Forks, and while 18 men including Coulter, went up the Jefferson to trap. Another group traveled down the Missouri from the Three Forks to do some trapping. The balance stayed and built a fort, a 300-square-foot stockade between the Jefferson and the Madison Rivers. And within just a day or two, while the fort was nearing completion, Coulter with his men, they were attacked by Blackfeet. They were up on a tributary of the Jefferson River. Five men in that group were killed by the Blackfeet. Their beaver plus some supplies were taken. Coulter was one of those who made it back to the fort. And then for several days, the fort was under siege. And another problem was grizzly bears. This is when grizzly bears had a greater domain over the area, obviously. And finally, Coulter reached his breaking point. He threw down his hat and said, "I will leave the country day after tomorrow and be damned if I ever come into it again." And he did. He was given permission to leave by Menard. He and a couple of other guys snuck out of the fort at Three Forks, made their way across the valley, traveling by night, hiding by day. He made it back to the Yellowstone, got to the Missouri. 30 days later, he was in St. Louis. And that was the end of the Western legacy of John Coulter. With John Coulter in the West, certainly a symbol of kind of some of the romantic mythicism of the mountain men, although it was, you know, really not a picnic at all. It was, if you were successful, if you could get back with a lot of beaver pelts, you could make good money, much more than if you were a common laborer in St. Louis. Some guys did it. Coulter was not one of them. What Coulter symbolized was that initial foray into Indian country, to a wealth of furs, and efforts would continue on by Andrew Henry, Manuel Lisa, and John Jacob Astor, as in the Waldorf Astoria. That's John Jacob Astor, who made a fortune in furs. But again, those are sidebars. It also hastened and signaled the demise, the destruction of the Native American way of life. It accelerated it. We all know from that point forward about what happened to so many tribes. One of the biggest problems, obviously, were the diseases that they could not combat that were brought to them by whites. Throw in on top of that whiskey, and it was only a matter of time before their way of life ended. When the beaver ran out and the demand for beaver dropped, the demand for buffalo went up. By the mid-1880s, there were hardly any buffalo on the plains. John Coulter, back in St. Louis, as we showed at the beginning, helped Clark put that map together. And also, he found out that Congress had given every member of the Lewis and Clark expedition a 320-acre land grant. But Coulter had borrowed so much money back out on the frontier for arms, traps, yada, yada, he had to sell that in order to help pay off his debts. He eventually collected $356.66 2/3. That's how they figured money back then, for his part in the Lewis and Clark expedition. Married a girl named Sarah Lucy, and they had a daughter, Evelina. Again, he did have the son, Hiram, who had been born in 1804. Coulter and his family settled near Dundee, Missouri, between the towns of Washington and New Haven, right on the Missouri River. Became neighbor and a good friend of Daniel Boone. Boone had his own run from the Indians, too, back in, I think it was in Kentucky years earlier. I don't know why it is all the famous mountain men had to run the gauntlet or run from, but that's what history tells us. In 1811, John Jacob Astor's Pacific Fur Company representatives came up the river and met with John Coulter. Wilson Hunt was a partner in that fur company, and he hoped to talk Coulter into coming with him so he could show him the way. Coulter may have been tempted, and not, he may have been tempted to come back, but he decided, no, he has a wife, a child, two children. Can't do it. But he and other mountain men told Hunt, don't even think about following the Missouri all the way. Don't even think about taking the same route Lewis and Clark took, because you're going to be in Blackfoot country and you're going to be in big trouble. And because of that, Hunt took that advice and instead cut across the plains. Now, a really good book, maybe some of you have already read it, by Peter Stark. It's called Astoria. It talks about that expedition and what it went through. I give it a really high recommendation. War of 1812 breaks out again. Coulter turns down the offer to go back up. Nathan Boone, the son of Daniel, is in command of the Missouri Rangers to fight tribes in the Missouri River area who were allied with the British. Coulter signs on. But he's only with them 2 months. 2 months later, in 1812, wasn't feeling well, he returned home, and he died of jaundice. After all he'd been through out on the frontier, all he'd been through in this part of the American West, he died relatively young, barely 40 years old. He died of natural causes. He's buried on a promontory near Dundee, overlooking the Missouri River. And John Coulter Buffs, a little long-winded here, John Coulter Buffs can't agree exactly where the burial spot is. Yeah, we're talking burial sites just a mile or two apart, and they're still fighting over where he's planted. I don't know. Anyway, the legend of John Coulter's gone on. Coulter Bay, Coulter Hall here at MSU, Coulter Mountain down in the Absarokas, the Coulter Run every September. His name has gone down in lore and in legend. Motion pictures that kind of depicted his ordeal. Cornell Wilde's The Naked Prey. I don't know if you've ever seen that. And another good one is The Mountain Men with Charlton Heston and Brian Keith. There's several books that have been put together on John Coulter. And the one last debate they have is, did he leave any marks out west, kind of like William Clark did at Pompey's Pillar? Well, Coulter, 1810. This is on a rock on private property in Bighorn County, not far from Fort Raymond. Above it, Manuel Lisa, a year or two earlier, had inscribed his name. Most historians believe that is legit, that is real. But it hasn't been verified by everybody. All right? But again, it is on private property. So Coulter, we think, yes, did leave a mark. Another one, the infamous Coulter Stone that was found in the 1930s by a farmer in Idaho. Maybe if you look carefully up towards the top, you can see John is in there. It's given to a museum, I believe it is now with Teton National Park. But the consensus on this is it's a hoax. Probably done by the Hayden Party in the mid-1870s as they went through the area. Because again, now a lot of historians, they don't believe Coulter even went into Idaho. Okay? So that one has been dismissed as a hoax. The prior one, we know for sure. But again, Coulter didn't keep any kind of journals. He didn't write about it. It just came down in kind of an oral tradition when he got back to St. Louis. That's about all I know on the guy. I'll try to answer some questions as best I can, if anybody has any. One last thing. As I mentioned, there are several books. One of the best ones is a relatively new release, The Mystery of John Coulter, The Man Who Discovered Yellowstone. So, that's it.